Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Jonathan Northcroft of the Sunday Times, and Jordan Jarrett Bryan, the broadcaster. Apologies to Chris Martin and Coldplay, but it was a sky full of fireworks and a season full of stars. After 30 years, Liverpool were entitled to write their own lyrics. The Premier League title lift turned into a mass selfie, an emotional communion with fans who were heard but not seen until later. The triumph has been collective, both spiritually and in a football sense. It has brought club, city and community even closer together. Jurgen Klopp understandably sees the title as a milestone. Now, Johnny, since football never stands still, what's next on the horizon?
I think there's plenty next for Liverpool, and the motivation for that for Liverpool will come from within. I mean, this is a team that has probably been able to replicate their previous season 97 points, do just as well this year by shutting out everything else, shutting out what Manchester City have been doing. So I think that they will continue to try and get better. Remember, this is a squad that's still relatively young. You look at key players who are still the right side of mid to late 20s. What will matter is the other team's ability to catch them up.
Yeah. Is Klopp almost killing two myths at one time here, Jordan? You know, those myths being the relentless pressing style that he, you know, encapsulates is too draining to sustain for an entire season. And also that there must be constant and expensive reshaping of the squad via the transfer market.
In answer to the first point, yes, I think he's proven that, you know, when he first came here, he clearly underestimated the intensity of football in this country. And we saw in the first couple of seasons how they burnt out by Christmas and they just tailed off into the new year. However, he seemed to have kind of got the balance right in its last two seasons of keeping that intensity that obviously is a hallmark of his team's football, but also balancing that with knowing when to press, knowing when to go hard, knowing when to give everything and when to be a bit more intelligent and cute about pressing and you know, offering that much exertion in their football. Doing it for 80, 90 minutes clearly doesn't work in most leagues, let alone this league. And I think he very quickly, you know, after a year or two, realised that. In regards to sort of the second, what was your second point, your question there?
Well, in as much as the, you know, and we look at his rivals or Liverpool's natural rivals, they are talking about more expensive reshaping of their squads. And it's a constant theme, whereas Klopp is saying, well, he might tinker a little bit, but it's maybe only one or two players at most.
That's right, yeah. I think I'm interested to see what he does in two particular areas next season. I think that he needs to refresh the front three. And I know a lot of people might think that's crazy because they've scored, you know, so many goals in the last couple of years. They're one of the best front threes in world football. But they're all in and around the 30-year-old mark, I believe. And I just wonder if after 2 years, a Champions League and a Premier League of really getting everything out of that front three, they're going to need, if not one of them replacing, but to find, if not that, finding some kind of legitimate backup that keeps those front three hungry and on their toes. And the other area, I think, is fullback. And I don't think those the Robertson and Alexander-Arnold would need necessarily replacing, but I think they've been so, again, phenomenal for two seasons. I'm interested to see how he keeps those fullbacks hungry, how he pushes them onto the next level. Does he give Alexander-Arnold and Robertson, say, targets? Say, okay, this season, your target, the two of you, I want 10 to 12 goals from you two this season. And, I don't know, 15 minimum assists each from you guys. I'm really, and we know that's a very key part of how Liverpool win their games and score their goals. So if they're going to spend in any particular area, I think it needs to be in one of the front three areas, in either finding an adequate someone that maybe isn't quite as good as a front three, but better than Origi, good luck with that, or finding maybe backups for the fullbacks that can actually really keep those fullbacks hungry, focused, and striving to be even better and make sure that this last two seasons hasn't been a peak for those fullbacks.
What about people like, I don't know, Rhian Brewster coming back from Swansea? There is a cadre, Johnny, of good young players coming through there. Do you expect them, given the extent of the ambition, to be given sustained chances, or will actually Klopp go back into the market?
Well, I think he needs to do a combination of both. And some of those youngsters are outstanding. Jordan's right about the need to refresh things a little bit, because if you look at how great teams sustain success, and, you know, kind of always feel like a bit of a broken record going back to Alex Ferguson, but he is our template for somebody who was able to do that with a team. There was always something that came in to refresh a Manchester United team once it had achieved a landmark. The ideal will be to do it as much as possible from within for financial reasons. I think if they could achieve that balance of giving those kids a chance, and Rhian Brewster could be that figure that comes in to help refresh the attack. But if they could also make one special signing as well, that might just, you know, help everything in terms of just pushing things on.
Yeah. If success is collective in nature, as we talked about right at the top of the show, Jordan, who in your view are the dominant individuals, the most significant figures?
I think I'm going to go for two, and it's hard in this Liverpool team to just pick two. But I think, first of all, Sadio Mane is just phenomenal. I think, and again, this might sound a little bit weird, but I still think he's underrated. I think what he offers that Liverpool team is something that I just don't think Salah, for all Salah's goals in the last 2-3 years, and Firmino's link-up play, and he's off the ball running, that allows Mane and Salah to do the damage that they do. I just think Sadio Mane is a collection of all three of those qualities. I think his movement off the ball is brilliant. I think the goals that he offers speaks for itself, as well as the pace he offers, defensive cover he offers. I think he's a really key component of many key components in that side. And you know, the other obvious one, I think, is Virgil van Dijk. I actually think Virgil van Dijk this season has been absolutely phenomenal. And I still think he's been two levels lower than last season. I think he's dropped off this season a level or two. And I still think he's been absolutely, I think he will go down if on this trajectory as arguably one of the greatest Premier League, if not the greatest Premier League centre-back of all time. And I know people talk about Vidic, won multiple titles, Rio Ferdinand, Vincent Kompany, John Terry. I think 3-4 years' time, he could easily go down. He could surpass all of them. He looks like, another old cliche, but a footballer on the pitch of boys, a man on the pitch of boys. First of all, physically, he's huge. He doesn't have to actually break stride that much to catch up people who are really, really quick. He just seems always in control. He's talking to his teammates without ever seeming like he's flustered. In the air, you can't touch him. He's not afraid to go to the ground on the slide. I think if you take him out of that team, I think that they are a completely different team, not only defensively, but I think the attack get confidence knowing they have the best centre-back in the world at the back. So whatever happens, worst case, 9 times out of 10, he will get them out of jail. So they'll be the two key dominant figures, I would say, in a team of brilliant players, Alexander-Arnold, Henderson, we know those guys as well. But I'd pick those two as the two that I think are the most important out of all the important players they have.
Johnny, what about the relationship between Jordan Henderson and Jurgen Klopp? It's obviously acute on an emotional level. You can see that in the way they behave around one another. But what about on a footballing level? Is there complete trust with him? How does it work? How does that relationship work?
I think every team needs a manager's representative on the pitch. And I do think Jordan's emerged as that. I mean, one of the sort of things I'll never forget about this Liverpool team was going with them to the Club World Championship in Qatar in December. Incredibly difficult assignment, very competitive South American, Central American teams, difficult circumstances. And the player that drove them through that was Jordan Henderson. the games were hard, they were tight. The player with the sort of most ferocious desire to win of anyone at the whole tournament was Jordan. And I think he's got that extra level of maybe hunger or desire or whatever it is that Klopp himself wants and has got. And then you talk about tactically. I spoke to Wayne Rooney about this not too long ago, and he said he couldn't believe the tactical improvement or development in Jordan's game. And when they were together at England, he sort of said to him, what's Klopp been doing? You know, what's he like? Because I can see what he's teaching you. That's not to say Jordan wasn't tactically good before, but you know, Wayne was just saying he's you could just see somebody that's been absorbed so many lessons. So I think for those two reasons, I think tactically Henderson's very important, and then he's the embodiment of the hunger that he wants. And he's also the link from the past. You know, he's the guy that was there in 2013, 14. He's the guy that actually, you know, goes all the way back to Kenny Dalglish and his little leader. So there's a lot of importance in having Jordan Henderson around. And he was being written off a couple of years ago. You know, he had chronic foot injuries, weren't really sure if a player that was based on athleticism was going to sustain his career. And it was late 20s, given he had those injuries. And see him now is a bit of a marvel.
I must admit, I championed him as Footballer of the Year from about Christmas onwards. But true to my capricious nature, I actually voted for Rashford on you know, our precept and example rule. I just thought that what Marcus Rashford has done, you know, socially, way beyond the sporting sense, deserved that sort of recognition. As I said, that was pretty capricious, I suppose. Who did you guys go for?
So I spoke to you gentlemen just before we started recording, and I was telling you that I was batting between Mane and Kevin De Bruyne. And I said to you that I leant towards Mane. I'm changing my mind. I'm going back to Kevin De Bruyne. Now, I think for any player, to any team that wins the league, will have at least two or three worthy candidates of Player of the Year. I think Liverpool have got four, maybe five. So to beat a player that is in the mix, that's won the title, I think you have to do something. You have to be quite special. I think Kevin De Bruyne, the reason why I've changed my mind and gone back to him is because I think when I'm in the conversation of, this is my opinion, Messi aside, I think we're looking at the best player on the planet right now. I genuinely believe he is the second best football player in the world right now. I think what Kevin De Bruyne can do with a football, I think his influence on the team, again, in a team of hugely creative and world-class attacking and midfield players, David Silva, Bernardo Silva, Raheem Sterling, you know, wide, I think just says how good he is. I think, similar to my comment about Virgil van Dijk in 3 or 4 years, about him going down as the best Premier League centre-back of all time, I think in the next 2 or 3 years, at this trajectory again, I think De Bruyne could put down a claim to say he's the greatest Premier League player, period. I think he's that good. I think he can do everything. And I think he's not only got the technical skills in his locker to, you know, damage any player on the pitch, it's his work rate. I don't think there's any player on the pitch when De Bruyne plays that outworks Kevin De Bruyne. And I think it's a hallmark of Pep Guardiola's sides that I don't care how talented you are, I want to see how much you're prepared to work. And he obviously is bought into that 100%. So I've now gone back and forth. I love Sadio Mane. I think he's been absolutely phenomenal. And I think to give the award to someone that hasn't won the title, I'm one of those people that believes that the player normally should be a player that's won the league, unless there's someone else that's been phenomenal. And I think this season, I think Kevin De Bruyne has been beyond phenomenal.
Do you agree, Johnny?
Yeah, I do. And I find myself nodding to a lot of that. I mean, it's really difficult to choose between any of the Liverpool players, quite honestly, because they're such a great collective. And I'd agree that, you know, I think Mane's been the best, most important weapon they've had this year, the best player probably. Jordan Henderson's got the influence that we've talked about. Van Dijk's standards over 2 years have been incredible. Trent is developing into probably the best right back in the world. So you could go through the Liverpool team. It's hard to choose between them. And I wrote about this at the weekend. I think that's overcomplicating it. I think you take a step back and you just look at the league, and actually there's somebody that's overwhelmingly the best footballer, and it is Kevin De Bruyne. And he will go down as one of the greatest in Premier League history, greatest foreign players, maybe one of the best midfielders ever to play in England, for all the reasons Jordan talks about. And I instinctively do want to give it to one of the champions because, you know, I remember, for example, that United team that I've already mentioned in the 90s, they hardly won any of these awards. Scholes never got near it. Keane never got near it. In 99, David Ginola was player of the year and Fergie never forgot it. But I don't think giving the award to Kevin De Bruyne in that territory, I think it's just recognising somebody that's utterly special. And also, it means you don't have to choose between those Liverpool players.
And am I right in saying also he just missed out, was it two seasons ago, to, was it Salah or was it Hazard? There was a couple of years ago where it was him and some, was it Van Dijk? He missed out to someone. I think that the whole football community was split between De Bruyne and I think it was the year Van Dijk won it.
I think you're right about Salah. I think it was Salah.
Was it Salah? Okay.
Very close to winning it when Salah won it. And probably, you know, that came next. Like Salah had a really hot streak towards the end of the year.
He did.
And edged it. But for his body of work, since he arrived, De Bruyne, I think, deserves something.
I think we're probably all agreed that the most potent challenge next season will come from Manchester City. Let's just have a quick look at where they are at the moment. I think everyone agrees also that there needs to be a defensive restructure for City to reach the heights that probably they expect themselves to reach. Now, in that context, Jordan, there's a proposed Nathan Ake signing. Is that a sticking plaster rather than a solution to really obvious defensive issues?
I can't also make up my mind on Nathan Ake and whether I think he is of that level or maybe a level below. I think he's better than Bournemouth, but I can't work out if he is a Manchester City centre-back. I've always liked Nathan Ake. I think despite the fact that he, rumours were rife that Chelsea ended up letting him go and then didn't exercise their clause to bring him back because they just thought that he was too short for a centre-back that they wanted. I think he's quite intelligent. I think he reads the game reasonably well. I think he's quick. I think he's good on the ball. I think there are a lot of qualities that he possesses that make me think, okay, I understand why Pep Guardiola is at least looking at someone like him. But I do think there's an element of there's no one else out there at the moment that is gettable without spending Virgil van Dijk type money. And I'm not sure. I think the Maguire the dismissal of Man City not pursuing that fee says that Manchester City just don't want to. There's no one out there they feel is worth spending 70, 80, 90 million pounds on. So there is an element of sticking plaster with Nathan Ake in the sense that he's not going to break the bank in terms of fee, but he's got Premier League experience. He has some of the qualities that I think Pep Guardiola wants. I mean, him next to Laporte next season, do I see that as a Premier League winning centre-back duo? I'm not totally convinced. Do I think he could do a job within a squad at Manchester City as maybe their third or fourth choice centre-back? Yeah, I do. But I think I do have concerns that if Manchester City think that Ake is the answer to making up 20-odd points, I think they're a little bit deluded there. I think he's good. I just not sure if he's the guy to bridge that gap. But I think this is about Manchester City feeling that there's just no one out there that is. They will spend 80 million if they feel they can get value for money, and they clearly feel there's no one out there that they can get that money. And they refuse to spend 80 million on someone like a Koulibaly, who they clearly feel maybe is on the slightly downslide of that hill and the hype that everybody was on a couple of years ago.
If you're Pep Guardiola, Johnny, your priorities would be what?
Well, it would absolutely be the centre of defence, but it would be the defensive side generally because they've got two issues, actually. The centre of defence isn't good enough and they've lost
fullbacks.
The greatness of Fernandinho as that defensive midfielder. You know, he's had to play at the back most of the season. When he's gone back into midfield, I think you can see that in his mid-30s now, athletically, he doesn't quite have that mobility to get around and snuff out the dangers that he used to. And I'm not quite convinced about Rodri. I think he's a very, very good footballer. Not quite Sergio Busquets yet. He might grow into that, but he's not there yet. So I think they actually need something top class in terms of protecting him in the midfield. But you go back, overwhelmingly, the number one priority is centre-back. Ake is a really decent package, but not as a number one centre-back. He's a replacement for Otamendi, but what they need is a replacement for Kompany. And if we're looking at the Liverpool template, they did go big on goalkeeper and centre-half. They broke the transfer kind of parameters. And I think City need to... City's transfers are very, very sort of well-structured. They're all kind of round about 50 million. You know, they do the same kind of transfer over and over again. Someone in their early 20s, round about 50 million, blah, blah, blah. Served them very well. But I think in the same way that Liverpool just, you know, changed their parameters to get Van Dijk, I think City need to do the same. And it's not an era where there's lots of great centre-halves around in the world. And you keep coming back to Koulibaly as he might be, you know, might be slightly older than City want, but he also might just be the option that's out there. I can't really think of anyone else outstanding to bring in, but they definitely need that absolute top-class dominant centre-half.
I think it's also this question that needs to be asked about why they haven't produced a centre-back yet. You know, for their you know, glossy, fantastic academy they've got there, why isn't there a centre-back coming through in the years they've had this academy? You know, why are they not producing a centre-back?
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? they took Garcia from Barcelona, and I think he's got a year left on his contract. Pep obviously has faith in him because he is playing him.
He is, yeah.
But you read the runes from Barcelona's end. They want Garcia back, and I think he will probably go back at the end of his contract. So, to your point, I think, you know, the bigger picture about the club, that academy, unlike say Chelsea, hasn't really produced for them. You know, with the obvious exception of Phil Foden coming through. While we mention Chelsea, Jordan, do you expect them to get the top four place that Frank Lampard acknowledges is a key performance indicator?
I do. I think they'll get the points, or even a point that they need in the final game that gets them that Champions League, that secures the top four spots. I think if he does get that, he's had a really bizarre season. I'm really intrigued by Chelsea's season this year. And I think Champions League, and if they win the FA Cup final, would represent a very good season, for a very good first season for Frank Lampard. But I look at the stats of Chelsea's league season. I think it's like 12 defeats this season. I mean, that is a phenomenal amount of defeats, and to still get top four probably says more about the league overall than Chelsea itself. But I do think it's important for them and for him to get that fourth spot, and I do think they'll get it. I think the signings that they've made and are making show that they are serious about, you know, joining that club again of teams that genuinely can compete for the title. Lampard's obviously from an era where that's all he knew. You know, as a Chelsea player, that's what they did. They competed and won titles, and he's very desperate to get them back there. But I do feel that they will secure that top four spot. And I'm a bit disappointed in Wolves, because I think Wolves have really blown it in the last couple of years. I think Wolves genuinely had a really good chance of getting top four. And I think we had, with the last game of the season, with Leicester going to United and Wolves playing Chelsea, that could have been set up for such a phenomenal final game of the season with four teams scrapping out for Champions League spots. But, you know, Wolves have kind of blown that. But I do think, and I'll ask you a question, that they will get, and I do think it's very important for Lampard that they do get it.
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious, isn't it, Johnny, that a bit like City, you know, defensive failings are very stark, especially at set pieces, I thought. And I think that, you know, Chelsea have actually conceded more goals than Brighton. Now, let's look at their recruitment strategy, if we can. Are they going for the shiny toys? You know, I'm thinking of Timo Werner. Looks like Kai Havertz is going to come in. You've got Hakim Ziyech. Maybe instead of the more pragmatic signings that they need, new goalkeepers, central defenders, maybe a fullback, or will money be found for both of those priorities?
Well, it's hard to see them continuing to spend at the rate they're spending. I mean, I'd be amazed if they follow up Havertz with then a 70 million centre-back and a new 60 million goalkeeper, but that's actually what they need. And there's an element to the spending that is kind of, it's like Arsenal used to be, or maybe still are. You know, it is chasing the next exciting attacking player. And it's what, I mean, they're going to be an incredible watch. And the players they're signing are really good. I mean, Werner, really good. Havertz is a sensational talent. Pulisic has been a brilliant recruit. Ziyech will be good. But as we saw in last night's game against Liverpool, the 5-3, as we've seen all season, the team that conceded into the 50 goals. That ain't going to win you the title. It might win you cups, but it is not going to win you the title. Mm. And compounding their problems, I think Rudiger's declined. He used to be their one banker. Kante, maybe one of my favourite players in the whole league. I do worry about him now. He's into his late 20s and maybe athletically again, he's starting to decline. And you come back to the goalkeeper, they've just got to bite the bullet. I know they want him to be there, Alisson. They spent that money. And there's an element that they're trying to almost keep playing him to try and, you know, they're like a gambler chasing losses with him. They want him to prove right, but I don't think he's going to. He's just not good enough.
No, it is interesting, isn't it? Because if you look at Kepa, you know, I saw Kepa when he was coming through at Athletic Bilbao, and, you know, the buzz was, well, Real Madrid wanted him. He probably came into the Premier League too early. And is he almost an object lesson, Jordan, in a player who's obviously he's got a self-possessed personality, but really almost is out of context with the culture of the game over here? Maybe, you know, he should have stayed in Spain.
Possibly. I think the whole Kepa thing, I think the industry and football fans are overcomplicating it. I just don't think he's good enough. I think he's a good goalkeeper. I think he has some decent moments. I just don't think he's a goalkeeper that wins you a Premier League title. I don't think that he is the keeper that Chelsea thought they were signing. I think he's got two or three key flaws in his game. And I don't think you can have that if you want to be a Premier League and a Champions League winning goalkeeper. I wouldn't be surprised if they did cut their losses on him and replace him. I think there's a ruthless streak in Lampard, despite all the smiles and the, you know, the eloquent speaking that runs through Lampard, that I can see him going to Abramovich and saying, I want him out. I can't work with this goalkeeper next season. I know you spent a lot of money on him, but I need a better goalkeeper. Manchester City and Liverpool have arguably the two best goalkeepers in the world. There's a reason why they've won the trophies they've won in the last two or three years. Those goalkeepers are setting the bar. This goalkeeper, I wouldn't even put Kepa in the top eight goalkeepers in the Premier League. I think there are a lot of keepers better than Kepa. So I think the fact is just maybe he did leave. He should have stayed in Spain where the culture of football suits him. But I think there's also the fact that he's just not good enough. And just very super briefly, going back to Johnny's point about the Chelsea squad, I think there's a lot to be questions similarly posed about Manchester City's academy. I think the Chelsea academy that the players have brought through in the last two or three years has been hugely overrated and overhyped. And there's a high chance that if Chelsea do bring in two or three more additions to tie up, you know, shore up their defence, there's a strong chance that they could be having an 11 next year, doesn't have any of their youth products in their team. I like Mount, but there's a chance that Mount, Loftus-Cheek, Hudson-Odoi, Tammy Abrahams, none of those players could be in Chelsea's first 11 next season. So for all of the plaudits they've been getting for bringing these young talents through, I find it interesting now the transfer ban's been lifted. Within 18 months, 2 years, they may be reverting back to what the Chelsea was that we knew 5-10 years ago and having no young homegrown products in their team. But yes, a team full of stars, but international expensive stars.
Yes, and I'll argue against myself in a sense here, because I think it was 26 of Chelsea's 67 goals this season have been scored by players aged 22 or younger. But does this point up the fact, Johnny, that a youth policy by its very nature has limitations? You know, I probably disagree with Jordan on Mason Mount. I just think he's probably been overplayed in the restart. But in general terms, you know, we all talk about he's one of our own, wonderful, you know, homegrown players, you know, the emotional bond with the fans. Is that so much romantic hot air?
No, it's not hot air in the sense that when you do get that player that has all of that, and you go to Trent Alexander-Arnold at Liverpool, then...
And Mason Greenwood at United, I suppose.
Yeah, Mason Greenwood, you know, that player, if you can find them, has got a value beyond any signing you make, because he embodies the culture of the club and he embodies the fan base, and there's a real power to that. But they're special players, and it's an interesting crossroads for that Chelsea academy, because at the start of the season we thought, well, yeah, you know, Tomori, we've forgotten about Tomori, you know, he's arrived now, you know, Abraham's arrived, Hudson-Odoi has just signed this new contract. He was going to be going to Bayern Munich a year ago, but now he's staying at Chelsea. And a year on, as Jordan said, we might be looking at a complete rethink on that, and Chelsea going back to older ways. I think they've been unlucky with some things, like the injury that Hudson-Odoi had. He just hasn't been the same, and it was a bad injury that he had. Loftus-Cheek, poor fella, his whole history's just been getting dogged by these injuries, and you know, he's now moving into his mid-20s. You wonder if they're starting to think about cutting the losses on him. I think Abraham and Tomori are the two that, from an outside point of view, Chelsea have never actually been sure about. You know, the loans that they gave them until finally giving them a chance when Frank arrived tells me that maybe they've never quite been sure about those two. But the players that they're signing are key players, young players, and attacking players in exactly the areas that they're already covered in terms of their own talent. And apart from Mount, I am wondering now who exactly of that youth crop Frank Lampard sees as an integral part of his future. I think he really does believe in Mount, and I think he's right to believe in Mount. But the rest, I have question marks about them now. Maybe the fullback as well. But that's, I wonder about the rest of them. And it's some kind of shift, really, from where we thought Chelsea were at the start of the season.
What about Manchester United, Jordan? You know, frankly, they looked exhausted in that West Ham game. They only need a draw at Leicester on Sunday. Have they got enough left in the tank?
I don't know, is the answer. I mean, you'd like to think that, you know, the fact that they only need a draw would be enough to galvanise them to you know, really give a 90 minutes of oomph just to kind of cross that line. I think Leicester will go into this game sniffing a little bit of blood. I think that they will be thinking, despite the fact that they're not on a good run themselves, I think, another cliche, it's a bit of a cup final for both teams, but I think more so for Leicester. Although I think United need Champions League football more than Leicester, I think Leicester will feel that they deserve Champions League football more than United. And I think they do as well. They've had a really horrible restart to the league. And even since, I think, January, their form hasn't been particularly great. I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer got a lot of, in my opinion, unfair stick for changing the team against Chelsea in the semi-final of the FA Cup. I do feel the couple of games leading up to that semi-final, United were looking a little bit leggy. And I think if you look at it objectively, of the three competitions that are out there for United, the Europa League, top four spot, and the FA Cup, I think you have to say, if you've got a squad that's getting tighter and more and more tired, the FA Cup, getting to a final of the FA Cup is the least important. I think the West Ham game that they subsequently drew was more important than the Chelsea game. So I understood why he made those changes. It backfired. It didn't work. But I think that it's been compounded by the fact that they drew the game that I think was the more important game following that semi-final game. So I think it actually will end up being a draw. I think Leicester will really give it 100%. I think they'll just miss out. But I've been very, very critical of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I still, I think I said to you on the last time I was on your show, Mike, I still can't believe he's the manager of Manchester United. But fair's fair. Let's give him credit. You know, if he gets them top four and possibly Europa League in the bank, you know, it's hard to argue against that.
You know Leicester really well, Johnny. What's gone wrong?
I mean, I guess that suggests there's a problem. And I don't think there's a issue that's suddenly arisen. It's just the season evening itself out. They overachieved at the start of the season. I'm not a big one on the whole XG thing, but you know, the XG acolytes will tell you that Leicester scoring way more than their expected goals and getting more than expected points. And it's probably evened itself out a bit. They are tired. We know they've got a small squad. They're relying on key players who are patently knackered. They've lost Maddison and Chilwell to injuries. Their best player, probably Ricardo, has been out since March. And the impact of that on a little squad is always going to be considerable. So I think it's no more than that. If I had one criticism, I'd say maybe Brendan has tinkered a bit.
I was going to ask Johnny that question to you, actually. Yeah, how is his management of the team in the second half of the season? Are there questions for him, do you think?
I think that I don't think he's caused the problems. I think they're, as I say, caused by small squad and the need to freshen things up. But his reaction to them has been to try and make tactical solutions. And I think he's overdone it, actually. I think the Bournemouth game, when he took off Kelechi at half-time, probably the moment he just went overboard in terms of those changes. So, yeah, he has to look at that. He has a question to answer there. they got, you know, we're talking about that showdown. It is between two very tired teams, mentally and physically tired. It's like two boxers in the 15th round or something like that. They both look knackered. It's quite a hard one to call, but I think that although United are tired, I think Leicester are just as tired, and probably agree with Jordan that United will get the point they need.
Okay, let's look at the other end of the table, if we could, and relegation. Are we looking at instant karma for Watford?
Well, I'd like to think so, because that decision to sack Nigel Pearson, even, you know, in the ranks of trigger-happy Watford decisions, is still number one, and that's some list. It goes down as one of the oddest Premier League decisions, I think. Clearly, an attempt to just get that short-term bounce somehow and get that extra point. And you could see by the performance against Manchester City that it's had the opposite effect. It's deflated the Watford squad further. And look, I don't wish ill on any club, so I'm not going to say, oh, they deserve to go down. But I'll put it this way, that Nigel Pearson deserved the chance to keep them up, and now he doesn't have the and now he's removed. Then, you know, personally, I've got less emotional buy-in as to what happens to them or not, because you can't feel too much sympathy for the owners if they do go down. That's probably the best way to put it.
Don't you feel, Jordan, you know, that life comes at you very fast in football, and sometimes what goes around comes around. I'm thinking, okay, they've got to get something at Arsenal on Sunday, Watford. Now, will Troy Deeney, whose leadership qualities I love, regret his no cojones jibe from a couple of years ago?
No, I actually think they're going to win. I actually think Watford win that game. And that's coming from an Arsenal fan. I think they're going to win that game. I think.
Oh, that's why then, isn't it? It's the natural pessimist in you coming out.
I think Watford are going to find a way to win that game. I think Arsenal, I think their eyes are on the cup final. I think Arteta will want them to be on job and, you know, focus on this game. But I think it is quite difficult to motivate yourself for a game that doesn't really mean anything. Okay, people will say this place is up for grabs. And off the back of the 1-0 defeat to Aston Villa, all the players that came in on that game didn't put their, you know, do a good job putting their hands up in the air for a place in the finals. So, you know, there's an argument that maybe some will on this game, but I think Watford are going to win that game. I think I'm the only person that wasn't surprised about the sacking of Nigel Pearson, not because I think he's done a bad job, but I think Watford have shown us over the last five or so years, these new owners, all they care about is staying in the league. And I think once you remove the kind of emotional element of their decision, they don't care. All they clearly think that sacking him is going to give them that kind of shot in the arm to kind of cross that line and stay in the Premier League. And if it backfires and they do go down, well, then they'll have to deal with the consequences. And it was a bad decision. But I don't think they look at these decisions of appointments and sackings through the same prism that I think a lot of us do. They don't care. All they care about is staying in the league. They don't care about coming top 10 European football. All they clearly care about is staying in the Premier League. And I think every decision they make, whether we think it's good or bad, I think it's made through the prism of all we care about is getting that Premier League money and staying in the top division in England. So I actually wasn't, even by Watford standards, I wasn't surprised when they sacked him. It was a bit like, oh, okay. But I think a lot of people are forgetting their recent history. This is what they do. And I think that their actions are guided by all we care about is staying in the league, and that they think for better, whether we agree or not, they think that this is the decision to make to stay in the league.
Yeah, I spoke to someone who should know, and basically it became pretty clear that there are all sorts of stuff going on in that dressing room. So it will be interesting to see if it all works out for them. You know, I would tend to say, you know, despite what you said, Jordan, that probably Villa have got the better fixture at West Ham. They're safe, which I think we should give credit to David Moyes, you know, for that achievement. But do you think they've got that slender one goal difference advantage? Do you think they could do it, Johnny?
I do. They've played the best out of the relegation contenders out of the three since restart. They've been quite consistent, Villa. I've been watching them thinking if they just had a striker, they'd have been safe by now. And West Ham achieving safety at Old Trafford's enormous, because it does mean that they don't have anything to play for. I think Villa will be okay. And I just think, take on board what Jordan said about what the owners do. Watford, they just want to get that sort of short-term boost of sacks. But it was the wrong decision in those logical terms. I think they're spent. So I just do see it as maybe Bournemouth could conjure something at Everton, but my money would definitely be on Villa. I think they'll get a point and that'll be enough.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll put my neck on a block. I do think that Bournemouth probably are at the end of the cycle and probably are a distant third favourites to avoid the drop. I just want to dwell briefly on the madness of the Championship and also to welcome back Slaven Bilic. You know, a manager who deserved more, certainly at West Ham. You know, he's come back from Saudi Arabia to actually galvanise West Brom. And he's almost produced a typical team, which is bigger than the sum of its parts. You glad to get him back, Jordan?
I am. I like Slaven Bilic. I like him. I think I like honest people. I like individuals that speak their mind and have no filter. And he's got very little filter. And I like those sort of people. Not only as a journalist, because it's good copy for us, but I just think I think one of my main frustrations about the Premier League, and I think football generally nowadays, is the lack of characters and personalities. I think we're seriously lacking individuals that, whether they play for your team or not, just people you want to listen to and people that say something. I miss the days of goal celebrations. I miss the expressions of players, individuals that I think the amount of money that's in the game now and social media has quelled. I think I really dislike this kind of robotic, PR'd individual we now have, managers and footballers in the league. And I think he's someone that isn't PR'd. He's not marketed. He says what he wants. He says it how he wants. I think the fact that English isn't his first language actually helps people like me, because it means that he can say what he thinks he wants to say, but say it in a way that actually is maybe not the way that he probably, if it was his first language, would say it. I love him. I think he's a good manager as well. I think he was harshly treated at West Ham. I think he was a victim of the ownership there at West Ham. I think he's a good manager. I think he's good enough to be in the Premier League. West Brom, I'm less happy about, because I felt for years, I don't know what the point of West Brom is. They're a team that, I don't mean to be disrespectful, he says, being disrespectful, but they don't play good football. They don't produce players. They don't win anything. I just don't understand what the point of what the... This sounds really rude, I know, but I'm struggling to see what, as a non-West Brom fan, I get from West Brom being in the Premier League. At least with Norwich, they've played a decent brand of football. Okay, lost a lot of games, but they had some good players. West Brom have never really had players that you're like, okay, I'll watch him, or he's decent. I'm less enthused about West Brom being back in the league, but definitely about Slaven Bilic being back in the Premier League, for sure.
Yeah, well, to steal their theme tune, Boing Boing, you know, they've been promoted to the Premier League for a record fifth time. I think, again, if you look at teams reflecting the personality of their manager, that West Brom team have won 25 points from losing positions in the Championship, which is more than any other club. Will that sort of durability, do you think, Johnny, be enough for them in when they're back with the big boys?
Not sure, because... I mean, they've got great firepower, and that's probably been the difference for them in the Championship. But, you know, they've kind of got... They talk about teams that are kind of not good enough for the Premier League but too good for the Championship. And, you know, West Brom and Norwich are probably top of that league. And I think West Brom have actually got a number of players that might come into that category. So unless they are able to refresh that squad, I think they might have a typical struggling... I'm really sorry if any West Brom fans are listening to this podcast. They'll be they might just face a typical West Brom Premier League season, i.e. struggling around at the bottom, unless they can do something. Slaven's an asset, of course, and he gives them a good chance, but they need to spend a little bit of that money. And that's probably the reason that they haven't really built anything with longevity at any time they've been in the Premier League. They've never really invested. They've had a sort of careful ownership with money. And if they really want to do something different, I think they are going to have to try and change that.
Okay, let's try and pull things together then. I suppose one of the things that you're speaking of there, Johnny, is you know, the reality that football, modern football, is being reshaped by an elitist attitude. Now, I think when we're talking about our thoughts for the day, your thought actually reflects that, doesn't it?
Very much so, Mike. Yeah, I mean, I wanted to just briefly talk about the the vote that's going to take place over whether to allow five substitutes to become a permanent feature of the Premier League, and it is about elitism. You know, this came in obviously for this sort of restart period as a special measure because of summer football demands on players, blah blah blah. And I think we could all understand that. But good ideas or rather ideas that the elite feel benefit them have got a habit of sticking in football, unfortunately, and this could be one. The bigger clubs are now keen to push this through as a measure for the future. And all it's going to do is it's going to give power to those clubs who can build the biggest squads, mm-hmm. have the most elite players on the bench. And it's going to detract from those who try and do it a different way. So what we've enjoyed this year with Leicester infiltrating the top four, with Wolves having such a good season, with Sheffield United challenging, you know, three teams who've done it a different way, but with smaller squads, the prospect of them being able to make impacts again is going to be lessened if we have a five substitute rule. It's entirely about benefiting those with the biggest squads, the richest budgets, and I think it would be wrong to allow it in through the back door while we're not looking. And the thing that will add the double whammy is these are different times financially. So with COVID, I think what's going to happen in every industry, and football won't be exempt, that the biggest corporations will flex a muscle and be able to pick off the weaker, smaller ones. So I think we're entering dangerous territory in football anyway. And things like the five substitute rule that give an advantage to the big beasts should be resisted. You know, what's wrong with three? Let's keep it there and let's not just reward those who've got the most expensive 25-man squads.
Okay. Jordan, what would you like to follow that with?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that has been mentioned quite a bit over the last couple of months, and it's something that's really important to me, and it's the seeing of no fans in stadiums at the moment for reasons that we understand why. And I'm really struggling to enjoy these games. I know nobody's loving seeing these games with no fans inside, but I'm really, really, I'm really having to force myself to watch these games for work purposes to make sure that I'm across, you know, lineups, games, results, all that sort of thing. But I think that on one side, you're getting a lot of people talking about how this period will show the authorities in the leagues and the governing bodies the role and how important football fans are to football, and how, you know, how significant a role having the energy and the chanting and the noise and the booing and all that drama that comes from having fans in the ground is to football. But I think equally, I think we need to flip it and also remember that I hope football fans really appreciate and remember what they're seeing. And going back to the top of the show, talking about Kevin De Bruyne, I'm hoping that when we do get back into football grounds, that we do appreciate the artistry of players like De Bruyne, like Silva, like certain individuals in this league. And I think as football fans, I'm hoping that having not been in the grounds for so long, when we do get back in, we almost fall back in love with football again because of some of the players that we're seeing as well. You know, Mason Greenwood, I think, is a phenomenal talent. I'm liking Saka. I like Mason Mount. And there are other individuals I could name as well. But I think as well as the governing bodies appreciating football fans once we come back into the grounds, I really hope also the football fans themselves appreciate the artistry, the joy, the passion, the fun of what it is to see some of these geniuses at work. And I think it was just watching the pictures last night of Liverpool lifting the trophy, it felt really wrong. And I don't say this very often, but I had sympathy for Liverpool fans last night and not being able to, 30 years you've waited, and the year you win it, you can't be there to see your team and your captain lift the Premier League trophy. And the players did their bit. You know, they did the whole pretending like the ground was full. You know, the chanting and the cheering and the beating the chest to the fans as if they were there in the stands. But we all knew there was no fans there, so it felt a little bit perverse and a bit awkward. I just hope that everybody appreciates football fans once we are allowed, including football fans, once we are allowed back into the grounds.
Yeah, well, I'll sort of second that and maybe talk about the players as well. Now, you know, once upon a time in a galaxy far, far away, I helped to oversee the development of 30-odd Olympic sports. Now, what struck me at the time, which was in the build-up to the Beijing Games, was how far football was behind in terms of looking after players. Now, it's changed, of course. As the game has become quicker and more physically demanding, science has caught up. a lot of money and a lot of expertise has been put to good use. But now we're on the cusp, I think, of the latest improvement. As the pressure intensifies, there's increasing evidence of mental health issues. That's why Brighton deserve credit for their pioneering move in opening a performance psychology and wellness department. A really sort of grandiose title, isn't it? But it's overseen by someone with experience in rugby, cricket, and the NFL. It's a really significant step forward. You see, we treat footballers as commodities, but they're human beings. Everyone, and by that I mean fans, coaches, club executives, and journalists, need to think of the person, not the player. Thanks to you once again for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.